From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Today on the show, is there such a thing as too much citrus? Find out how one California cook is using up his backyard bounty. The largest garlic knot you've ever seen? Does free food in the workplace make you a better employee? Well, Google certainly thinks so. And find out what Ho Chi Minh, Malcolm X, and Parker House rolls all have in common. But first, let's see what's fresh and in season this week at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. Spring is right around the corner, and we're looking for new things to watch peeking up out of the ground here at the market. And, of course, we'd like to turn to our resident expert, Amelia Saltzman, who wrote the Santa Monica Farmers Market Cookbook, who's here every week looking for the new things and helping us make these things delicious. So, Amelia, you've got a terrific recipe for us today. Simple, and yet it can take in everything in the market. Explain how that happens.
So what I've been doing, I've got this sort of master plan, and I call it a one-pot dinner, and it can be ready in less than 30 minutes, which I think is key. I'll give it to you this way, three basic steps, and then we can go into how you can vary it endlessly by what you find at the market. That's the most exciting part. So number one is starting an aromatic base of, let's call them alliums for the moment, onions, leeks, green garlic, something in that field, in that category. Second, we have vegetables that take, you know, maybe 10 minutes to cook. So we can talk about little potatoes, turnips, any number of items like that. So now we've got them softening. Then we're going to add some liquid to the pot. It can be dashi, it can be chicken stock, vegetable stock, beef stock, it can be water. Because basically we've got all these vegetables that are going to flavor the liquid, even if it's as simple as water. Cover the pot. And then about 5 minutes before we're ready to eat, the third step is to either nestle in some protein, such as chunks of fish or shrimp or cubes of tofu. And any very, very quick cooking green, you know, like a Napa cabbage, something like that. So those are the three steps. And in 5 minutes, the dinner is ready. You'll have perfectly poached fish, gently cooked tofu, depending on what you're looking for.
Can one have too many ingredients?
Absolutely. Because really, the point is to get a few ingredients tasting good and get dinner on the table quickly and not spend a lot of time mucking things up. For instance, let's say we want something somewhat Japanese in quality. Well, if you'd made some dashi, the Japanese stock, that would be great. But you could do it as that you can also use chicken stock. You can also use water. But the vegetables I would use for that, let's say I would start with spring onions or scallions, which we're finding now, some green garlic chopped. Then I might add some cut chunks of winter squash, which we still have. Let's see, what else might I add?
Some Asian vegetables, like the bok choy and things like that.
Right, exactly. So then I might add something wonderful and green and cabbagey, like bok choy, or I might add turnips. I love the counterpoint of the slightly bitter turnip against the sweet squash. We've got turnips as a possibility, we've got bok choy, and we've got squash. So you let that simmer a few minutes with the stock, and then you might add some pieces of fish. Or you might just add tofu and maybe some shredded Napa cabbage. And 5 minutes later, you have a great meal. And one of the finishing tricks is to add some freshly acidic, a little rice vinegar, a nice squeeze of lemon or lime, something that really brightens it. And it's just fantastic.
Oh, this sounds so exciting. So, yeah, so you get this basic formula. Basically, it's a formula. And then you just pick stuff and just as your heart desires, you can, you know, just keep making it, keep adding it to it, keep making more. It sounds great. Thank you, as always, so much for the inspiration.
My pleasure.
That was Amelia Saltzman. She is the author of the Santa Monica Farmers Market Cookbook, and she has once again inspired us with her unique take on what's in season and how to prepare it here at the market. Amelia mentioned the English peas, and it's you've really got to keep your eyes open here because things are coming on all the time. I just went to Gloria to my stand here at the Wednesday Market. She's got some gorgeous English peas. And Gloria, let's ask, how long have they been coming in, and how long are you going to have them?
Okay, we usually start like at the end of December or in January. And we finish like in May, at the end of May, because in summer they get too
starchy.
Yes. So right now, they're real sweet.
And when you say they start in January, you mean you start harvesting them in January?
Yeah, we start harvesting. We planted it like in September, around there.
And you're going to have them here for about another how many more months?
At least another 3.5 months.
Okay, so basically the season's just getting started.
Yeah.
And they're going to be sweeter now, and as the season progresses, they'll get a little more mature, a little bigger.
If we let it get bigger. If we don't, try not to let it get bigger, because they get too starchy.
Oh, so it depends on the size, when you pick them at a certain size. Oh.
Yeah, that's how we pick it. We go in the plants and look for the, you know, the ones that are ready, that we think is ready. That's how we pick it.
That's a lot of work.
Well, it sure is, so hang pick.
Oh, so good. Well, they are really delicious. I think it's the cool weather and then the fact that they're very young makes them super, super sweet.
Yeah, that's what makes it good.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Gloria.
No, thanks to you.
That was Gloria Tamai. She is at three of the Santa Monica Farmers Markets and at many, many markets here in the Southland. You can look for her, and her produce is delicious. As you can see, handpicked with care. Be sure to join us this Thursday night, February 9th, at the Santa Monica Main Library for the very first of our annual library panel discussion series. This Thursday, the topic is Gardening on the Farm. The program is free, open to the public, and aftermarket treats will be prepared by Sal Marino from Il Grano. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
A recipe from Amelia Saltzman is on the Good Food blog. One thing you'll see right now at all Southern California markets is citrus. Market stalls are overloaded with lemons, limes, oranges, and grapefruits, with varieties way too numerous to count. Now, you may think that a glut of winter citrus is a good thing, but for those Angelenos with lemon and orange trees in their backyards, an overproducing citrus tree can be, well, a nuisance. The biggest problem of the season is figuring out how to use up all that beautiful fruit. Here with a few ideas is Russ Parsons, noted food writer and editor of the food section of the LA Times. He recalls the first time he discovered California citrus.
I remember, you know, when I was a kid and my dad would come out here on a business trip or something like that. And the first time he came back, he like carried this bag of citrus and he said, "It grows on trees." As if it was like, oh, my God. And, you know, my Tangelo tree is just, like, completely overloaded. My Meyer lemon tree is overloaded. I mean, you know, you complain about these things to people on the East Coast, and they say things like first world problem, right? But, you know, you've got this fruit. You want to do something with it. You want to make something with it.
So do you tend to use the same recipes for all citrus, like a lemon recipe you can sort of modify and use it for tangerines or oranges?
Absolutely. You know, I think that they're all different, but the kind of the physical property is the same. And so if you have a recipe that you really love for lemon, you can tinker with it and you can make it an orange recipe really, really easily.
You might need to add a little bit of lemon juice to that orange juice.
Especially with orange juice, because it's a little bit low in acidity. But there's other, you know, there's ways that you can play with it. Like, you know, and with the accenting seasonings. So, like, if I'm using tangerines, I love to add just a little bit of vanilla to it. Because when I was a kid, I was addicted to creamsicles. And that's exactly the flavor of a creamsicle. With grapefruit, add just a little, especially the pink grapefruits, add a little bit of Campari to it. It really kind of accents that bitterness of it. The basic framework of the recipe stays pretty much the same.
So when you're talking about tangerine juice or clementine juice or Tangelo juice with vanilla or grapefruit with Campari, my mind immediately goes to sorbets, which, of course, are cold and it's cold outside. What else can we do besides making ices?
I just love citrus salads. So, you know, you peel the citrus, slice it, then and it's great because you use a whole combination of things because you want the different sizes and the different colors. And so you just slice them into wheels and arrange them on a plate, and then a little bit of a flavored simple syrup, depending on what the combination is and what you feel like. I mean, it can be something as simple as just a little bit of vanilla in it, or maybe an herb like mint, or I mean, basil's great with citrus. Or you can get kind of weird with it, you know, like tea-flavored simple syrups, like a little bit of a chamomile tea. It adds this kind of musky quality to it that's really interesting.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
But probably my all-time absolute favorite thing to do with citrus is curds.
Curds are the best.
It is just, I mean, it's so seductive. It's this amazing, like, kind of magic.
It is,
you know,
magic.
Where you take egg yolks, whole eggs, orange juice or citrus juice, which you know is just going to curdle this. I mean, it's impossible. Some sugar, butter, and you stir them together and you heat them. And it just looks like a disaster. And then all of a sudden,
it's
very
perfect.
Gradually, it starts to thicken up and thicken up and thicken up. And finally, you come up with this absolutely luscious cream that's it's got the texture of like a hollandaise or something like that. It's just lovely. And you can use it in different ways. You can use it with, you could pour it into like little juice glasses. Small portions, sensible portions. We don't want to go up all a dean. Sensible portions and serve it with a shortbread cookie. Or, my favorite way, and I just did this Saturday night for dinner, is just use a tart shell, a pre-baked tart shell, pour it in, top it with some chopped pistachios just for a little bit of that crunch and for a little contrast on the color. It's just – it's such a lovely dessert. And if you get the right balance of citrus and butter, which in my case is usually on the butter side, it's absolutely one of my favorite desserts. Another thing that I liked, I learned from Deb Madison. It's in her seasonal fruit desserts book, and it's just terrific. And this is kind of like the opposite of lemon curd, because you actually feel very abstemious and you feel very sensible when you eat it. But it's you just juice up a bunch of fruit, and then for every 2 cups of juice, she uses about 3 tablespoons of cornstarch. You need to use a little bit more cornstarch than you would normally, because the acidity decreases the thickening power of the cornstarch. And then as much sugar as you want and whatever complementary flavorings you want. And you just, you just cook it until it thickens. And then I serve it with whipped cream, because you can't be too abstemious, right? You can't be too morally upright when you're serving dessert. It's not as unctuous as a curd. It's more like a pudding. But the flavor, because there's so little else, the flavor is very direct. I mean, the flavor is very pointed. It's not like this kind of melding of citrus and butter. It's like this is the pure flavor of the citrus fruit.
So do you eat it warm like a pudding, or do you let it chill down?
No, I chill it.
Wow, that sounds so delicious.
It's really nice.
What else do you like to do?
This is the weirdest recipe I think I've ever run across. And in fact, I didn't believe it was possible until I tried it. And then all of a sudden, it kind of made a little bit of sense. And I learned it from Amanda Hesser's website, Food 52. And it won one of their weekly contests. And it's called Lazy Mary's Lemon Pie. And it comes from a cook in Sonoma named Mary Comfort. And this is crazy, right? So you take a lemon and you quarter it and you take out the seeds. You put it in a blender with sugar and eggs and a little bit of vanilla. And you just puree the heck out of it until it's absolutely perfectly smooth. And then you bake it in a pie shell.
Thank you, Russ. It's been really fun.
Oh, it's always a pleasure.
That was Russ Parsons, noted food writer and journalist, and the editor of the food section of the LA Times. A recipe for a Lazy Mary's lemon pie is on the Good Food blog. Next up, Jonathan Gold eats the largest garlic knot in Los Angeles. That next after this short break.
This is producer Jillian Ferguson. You can connect with other food lovers on Evan's Facebook page, share photos, ask questions, and meet new friends. Search for Evan Kleinman on Facebook and click like.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Time now for a visit from Jonathan Gold. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Weekly, and he joins me every week with a restaurant suggestion. Today, we're heading to a tiny new pizza restaurant in Santa Monica.
It's Milo and Olive, and it's the newest restaurant from, Zoe Nathan and Evan Funky, who do the Huckleberry and Rustic Canyon.
So one would imagine they're using excellent farm-to-table ingredients.
Definitely. There are a lot of farmers' name checked on the menu.
And what's the dough like?
The dough for the pizza, which comes out of a wood-burning oven, as is de rigueur these days, is flat breadish, I guess. And it has a beautiful rise to it. The what do you call it? The corona.
Yeah, the little edge around.
It is really nicely risen. There's a crispness yet like a definite body in the middle. It's a pizza that you would consider eating just for the crust itself. It will remind you a lot of the Pizzeria Mozza crust.
And are the toppings spare or are they a little more Baroque?
Obviously, you can get a margarita, which is, you know, just the basil, the tomato, the mozzarella. But you can get fairly Baroque. My favorite of their pizzas is one with this sausage that they make using pork belly. And so it's a very fatty sausage, as you might imagine. It has a real giant, funky pork punch to it. You know you're eating pork. And it comes with braised greens. They could be beet greens. They could be spinach. It could be a mixture of different stuff. And a little tomato and mozzarella. And that's a different pizza, I think, than you've probably ever had. And you would definitely put it more on the Baroque side.
So is the restaurant really pizza-driven, or is pizza one part of the menu?
It's interesting because you would think that it would be pizza-driven, but you walk into Milo and Olive, and the first thing you got to know about it is that it's tiny. I mean, really tiny. The restaurant, it's cut in half, basically, and half of it is the dining room, and the kitchen may actually be bigger than that. There are literally two tables. They're big tables. It's eight tops. You will be sharing. And there are, I think, eight more seats at the counter. There's a bakery counter. I believe her basic bakery operations have moved over to Milo and Olive from Huckleberry. And there's a lot to eat that isn't pizza. If you went there and you didn't order pizza, you could have a decent meal, I think.
The bread must be pretty good.
The bread is really good. They take Filmagraph's pumpkins and they roast them. And those are such good pumpkins anyway, and concentrates the sugar. And they serve that with brown butter, sage, a little bit of honey, a lot of black pepper. And it's like comfort food, something that you'd make at home and be really happy with. There's crostini, which are wonderful, just slabs of her bread toasted nicely with just mounds of that bellwether ricotta on it.
Oh,
little
so
olive
delicious.
Oil, little pepper. And there's something that I think is probably going to be the fetish dish of this restaurant. It's something I've never seen before in this hand, which is what they call garlic knots. And we all know garlic knots. It's what you do with the leftover pizza dough. You serve it free as an appetizer. You put a lot of bad olive oil and garlic on it, and you send it out free. But this garlic knot is gigantic. I mean, it's the size of a big grapefruit. And it's tied at the knot with actual string, like a beggar's purse, I guess, or the thing that hobos sling on their back. Except it's not pure bread. The way you might think it is, you split it open, and inside are roasted garlic cloves.
That is genius and awesome.
It is a dish you're going to wear for the next couple of days. And there are desserts. Of course there are desserts. But I think the one that everybody should probably keep in mind sounds almost too simple, but it's a slab of grilled bread on top of which is melted chocolate, olive oil, and sprinkles of sea salt. It's big dish in Catalonia. I mean, Adria sometimes plays with it on his menus or played with it on his menus. And I think this is the first place in L.A. that serves it.
Chocolate toast.
Chocolate toast. If there's a fault with it, there's possibly too much chocolate, but you and I are the only two people in the world who ever have that complaint about anything, I think.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Jonathan Gold of the LA Weekly about Milo and Olive in Santa Monica. You can get the exact address and recommended dishes by simply texting the words good food to the number 69866. That's good food to the number 69866. And don't forget, you can also see Jonathan's restaurant suggestions on our Good Food restaurant map, which you can find on the Good Food blog.
Tomorrow is the Super Bowl, the once-a-year football extravaganza in which two teams, in this case the New York Giants and the New England Patriots, will duke it out on the field while we watch from home and most likely eat buffalo wings and seven-layer dip. In Indianapolis, where the Super Bowl is hosted this year, a few other dishes might be on the Super Bowl Day menu. Joanne Raitt Stuchen is the author of Cafe Indiana, a guide to Indiana's down-home cafes, and she's possibly the leading expert on Hoosier comfort food.
Indiana's small towns are characteristically defined, I think, as agricultural communities. The agricultural business is still strong in Indiana, especially in the north, where farmers raise corn, soybeans, and hogs. In southern Indiana, there are still farms, but very few and very small, tend to be family farms that the family has a hard time giving up.
Outside of the big cities, is small town life in these agricultural communities still pretty vibrant?
I would say that it is. I have this discussion very often with people who tell me the small town is dying. And I live in a small town of roughly 12,000. And I think the town is not dying so much as it is just changing. It's evolved from what it was in the 60s or the 50s or earlier. And it's different than those fond, powerful memories that people have of the 50s and the 60s. It's just different than it was.
So let's talk about food and the cafe, because when I think of a small town, I think of a life, a community life that is centered on where people can gather, have a cup of coffee, and talk. Is that true in small town life in Indiana?
Yes, definitely. The cafe is the community center, or is one of the more dominant community centers. Sometimes in very small towns, the post office is where everybody comes to pick up their mail from their P.O. box. Is a community center, but the cafe is this ritual place that is open from morning until typically mid-afternoon. And you get these cycles and these rounds of people coming in at various times of the day to eat and mostly to drink coffee and to talk and to, as they say, solve all the problems of the world.
And what's the food that we are most likely to find there?
Classic Midwestern farm food. Again, there's a difference between what you're going to find in the north and what you're going to find in the south in Indiana. In the south, you're going to find dishes that tend to lean toward pork and beans, whether it's green beans or pinto beans or great northern beans. Corn is very dominant, shows up in cornbread, which is a popular favorite kind of side dish that you'll get with different meals, but certain meals in particular. You're going to find those foods also in the northern part of the state, but up in the north, you'll also find a ethnic influence on the food. You might find up in the northwest, for instance, Eastern European traditions such as stuffed cabbage rolls. You're going to find also some Greek food up there that was brought by the Greek immigrants.
Is there a standout use of pork that one sees in many of these cafes?
Yes. The Hoosier national dish, the Hoosier state dish, is the breaded pork tenderloin sandwich. And this is, you take the big loin and you slice it into 1-inch thick pieces or as thick as you want. And then you take those slices, and some cafe owners will marinate them in milk or maybe buttermilk to soften them and to give them a bit of flavor and moisture, more moisture. Then those loins are either pressed by hand or sometimes pounded or in other ways tenderized and flattened. In Indiana, you will find the breaded pork tenderloin in endless varieties. We have what some people call the elephant ear breaded tenderloin, and that is a loin that's been pressed to what I describe as the size of a frozen pizza. So it's 1/4 inch thick and just huge in circumference. I find that the proportion of breading to meat is too high. It's higher than I like. So there are also other ways to make the tenderloin, and that would be to press them into a thick, meaty burger. So it all depends on the preference of the cafe owner and perhaps of the clientele of the cafe as well. What kind of tenderloin it's going to be, what size it's going to be. But they are, I would say they are the Hoosier Holy Grail. We have people who are on the pursuit, hunting them down from place to place, county to county, trying to find, quote, the best pork tenderloin.
Let's talk for a minute about the more carbohydrate-driven foods, the pie, the dumplings, biscuits. They must be really important as well in cafe life.
Yes, very much so. In fact, I think that generally I would define the food in a small-town cafe is to be as carbohydrate-heavy. This is not a place you want to eat if you are trying to diet, let me tell you that. The biscuits, the baked goods, the pies, the mashed potatoes, the noodles or handmade dumplings figure into one of the most iconic dishes in Indiana, and that is chicken and noodles or the alternative chicken and dumplings. The noodles and the dumplings may very well be made with the same recipe or a very similar recipe. It's just the way that they are handled and the way they're shaped and cut.
Now, what role does pie play in your typical Indiana diner?
Pie is not so common as you would think. I personally am a little bit worried about the state of pie in Indiana. There are people baking pie, and there are a few people baking a totally 100% from scratch pie. But mostly what I saw are what I call partway pies, and those would be pies with homemade fillings, but not homemade crusts. Indiana is known for a particular pie, and that is the sugar cream pie. This is a pretty basic pie that could be made with ingredients on hand in a skimpy larder or in a skimpy pioneer home. I've heard these types of pies called desperation pies, meaning you could make a pie with nothing. And this is a pie that you don't really find so much out of the Indiana borders, although, to be honest, the food historians have never come to any kind of consensus as to where this pie might have originated.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Joanne Race Stuchin, author of Cafe Indiana, A Guide to Indiana's Down-Home Cafes. A recipe for breaded pork tenderloin, or BPT, is on the Good Food blog. What are you cooking up for the Super Bowl? Let me know on my Facebook page. Search for me, Evan Kleiman, and click like. Coming up, would you be a happier employee if your company bought you lunch each day? Well, we're taking a field trip to the Google campus where breakfast, lunch, and dinner are on the house each and every day. That's in 1 minute here on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station. Search for KCRW in the podcast section of iTunes to find other programs like Bookworm, The Treatment, The Business, Unfictional, and DNA. And thanks for listening.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. It's often said that food is the way to a man or woman's heart, and the saying could not be more true when it comes to lunch at work. It's as simple as this. Buy your employees lunch, and they will like you, at least a little bit. Google, the internet mega giant, is one company that takes this very seriously. Good Food producer Jillian Ferguson recently took a trip to the company's Mountain View campus to find out just how good the Googlers have it.
Preparing for my trip to Google's Mountain View campus was a sobering realization of just how much Google is a part of my life. I use my Gmail to set up the interviews, used a Google document to jot down my questions, and then used Google Maps to guide me there. It seemed that Google, kind of like food, is not just something I enjoy, but something I need. I'd heard ridiculous rumors of the perks that Google employees, or Googlers as they are called, enjoy at work. Masseuses on call, beach volleyball, haircuts at work, and free food? These rumors turned out not to be rumors at all. You can schedule a massage anytime. There's a bowling alley on campus. And yep, free food all day long. The Google campus boasts 28 cafes run by 5 executive chefs. Employees have the option of breakfast, lunch, and dinner every weekday, lunch and dinner on the weekends, take-home meals, grab-and-go snacks, and even a full tea service 4 days a week. But the chefs don't stop there. Olivia Wu is an executive chef at Google.
Just in case you don't get enough food, Scott brings a truck and surprises you. It's called the Sneak Attack truck. So that's a very googly kind of name to give one of our programs. We find that most of our Googlers do breakfast, lunch, or lunch, dinner. But lunch is the main meal of the day. That's the big push. And my goodness, it's really tough. You have 28 choices of cafes to go to.
Scott Jim Bastiani is another chef at Google and the one responsible for the Sneak Attack. I asked him how employees decide where to eat. With so many options at your fingertips, how is a Googler supposed to keep track?
There is an Android app for that as well, for Googlers. So we make it very convenient for Googlers to go online and to be able to, in the cloud, at their fingertips, see what's on the menu. A lot of the engineers have set up little algorithms where they can search for specific foods that they want, and it'll email them when cheese pizza's on there or when something healthy or whatever they're looking for. They can find it at their fingertips. And we post our menus every day per shift, 30 minutes before we open. You'll know who's serving what. And not only do we list the menus, but we also list the hours of operation, and then you can make your choice to go where you want to go. And Googlers can go where they want to go, when they want to go, as long as we're open, as often as they want to.
When you eat at a Google Cafe, you're constantly reminded about the choices you are making. Every snack, beverage, and prepared dish is color-coded. Dishes labeled with a green sign indicate a healthy choice, while things like French fries are coded red to indicate caution.
The company is very alert to productivity and to the health of the employees. So ultimately, a healthy employee is a better employee in terms of not just of hours spent at the monitor, but their long-term health and how they feel about themselves. We adopted essentially the Harvard School of Public Health's recommendations, which is expressed in a pyramid and in a plate. And so that's the foundational information that Googlers have. And they can, there are many pages they can land on to read about that.
I quickly learned that labeling is a very googly thing to do.
As an information company, we really want to make sure that we're providing factual information to our guests. So you will see labels, whether it's for shellfish or for nuts, or for other allergies. We spend a lot of time with that.
Quentin and Liv worked on a new allergen recently that notated seafood with higher mercury counts. So you might see olive oil coated green because it's a healthy oil versus butter coated red. But you'll also see, you know, nuts and seeds called out with allergens. And like I mentioned, the mercury content on seafood, you'll see a little mercury sign next to that specific item.
So we recently sourced a soy sauce that is brewed in the artisanal way. And that's made by a very small family company in Taiwan. And that was because they make the soy sauce with a certain variety of soybean that's black. And it's made without any flour at all. So that takes care of our celiacs and people who are intolerant of gluten and flour. So we try to do those kinds of things whenever we can. It's at a way greater cost. But we felt in terms of the flavor and in terms of the health benefits we would gain, it was worth it. And also in terms of ease of labeling, we no longer have to do the wheat allergy sign every time we do soy sauce.
Okay, so now that I know that my dish is healthy, lacks gluten, and is low in mercury, what if I want it without tomatoes?
Yeah, that's a good question. Our menus are highly customizable. We actually, the Google chefs will go through every week and do ratings on the cafes. And one of the questions is, how customizable was the menu? Were you able to get the salad without cheese or were the nuts on the side? And so we actually critique that week to week. At the same time, Googlers know, and we always reiterate this, that if there's something on the menu that doesn't work for you, let the chef know.
Speaking of menus, I asked the chefs what was on the menu that day in their Google cafes.
You can start off with a slice of pizza that's made, obviously, with a house-made crust every single day. You could go to the carving station and get a slice of roast beef. You could get sushi that's made by our expert sushi chefs. Four different fresh soups that were made that day.
You could go to the salad bar and have anything that you wanted to compose yourself and really pick about 50 different options of the type of salad you would look for. Three different types of greens, five different types of vinaigrette.
At the diner, you could grab a burger, grass-fed, bison.
Fish prepared two different ways. A local halibut that's served with just a light ginger vinaigrette. Arctic char that's served very simply in a nigiri fashion.
Street food. Satay and maybe fried rice. Grass-fed beef done somehow, maybe a brisket. Cream soup that's made only with milk, not cream.
And just to reiterate, That is all free for Googlers and their visitors.
It's all free.
It's all free.
I have had a Googler tell me that a meal he's had at one of the Google cafes would be, for lunch, would be a $200 meal at a restaurant.
But what if all this just isn't enough? What if a Googler is too busy to eat? Do Google cafes deliver to your desk? Turns out the answer is no. But that doesn't mean you'll go hungry if you're trapped at your desk. There is a rule on the Google campus that you're never more than 150 feet from food. This is where the Google Micro Kitchen comes into play. Imagine the bodega of your dreams with an espresso machine, a fridge full of coconut water and soft drinks, a cereal bar, unlimited packages of fruit leather and Hawaiian potato chips, all free, of course. And now, imagine it 150 feet from your desk. Sounds like a recipe for the Google 15.
Anecdotally, there is definitely the Google 15. Some people attest to that, but we also hear from Googlers who say, I arrived here and I wanted to lose weight and it's so easy to do so.
I began wondering, what does all this free food do to a Google employee? Does it create a fuzzy feeling inside about going to work? Does it ruin your ability to pay for food when you go out to eat?
I think one way to sum that up is when we take off a few days for the holiday break and all the cafes are closed and it could just be for 4 or 5 days, there's not a year that goes by, we come back and I'm not getting a hug or an email or a compliment saying, not only did I have to cook for myself, but I didn't know where to find these products. It didn't turn out anything close to this. Or I went to a restaurant and I spent way too much money. Everyone is extremely pumped up about the food seen here, even though they're very passionate about how to improve it. And I mean, you can laugh about it. At the end of the day, everyone loves it. I think it is the high point of the job here. I would say that everyone needs a paycheck, but everyone looks forward to getting the food every single day.
In addition to feeding an army of 10,000 Googlers every day, these five executive chefs are spearheading a number of food-related programs. Liv started the first community-supported fisheries program in Northern California, connecting Google employees to the fishermen at Half Moon Bay. Quentin is in the early stages of building an aqua farm on campus. Scott coordinates with local food banks to deliver leftover meals. I'm not sure who has it better, the employees or the chefs?
We just spent this last week. We brought in a well-known gentleman by the name of Bruno Gousseau, who is sort of considered the master of sous vide cooking, which is sort of the next new technology for us to use in the kitchens. And we're embracing it and really excited about it and had a fantastic week. So yes, whether it's continuing education, going to health conferences, going out to farms, learning more about our local purveyors. We're actually on Monday, we're going on a crab fishing trip together as a team to sort of learn about what it's like actually to do it for real.
The chefs were in a hurry to return to their sous vide seminar. So we said our goodbyes and I headed downstairs to check out the cafes. I wanted to hear from the Googlers themselves what they loved most about the food at work.
Hi, my name's Winnie. I work here at Google, and I guess what I love most about food here at Google is just the variety. There's always something new. There's always something healthy or something that I've never heard of before that is fun to try, so it's never a dull moment.
My name is Terry. I work at Google. Basically, what I like most about Google is the food. Now, there's food everywhere, so you basically are always surrounded by food, and you can have it whenever you want.
My name is Mike. I work at Google. So today I ate a slice of pepperoni pizza, some weird yellow curry chicken thing. I had some Greek salad, and I had a pasta with lamb and rosemary. Very few of my meals have much of a theme other than everything.
My name is Sarah McPhee, and my husband Jonathan works for Google. And we have 2 kids, and so sometimes we'll come and meet him for lunch or for dinner. And there are always good options for our kids. They're little, so they're 1 and 3. And they often eat pizza and grapes. And then there's wonderful food for adults, too. So,
hi, my name is Reed. I work for Google on a product called Punched, and I really like the ice cream. It comes out of those Froyo machines, and you get to serve yourself. And you can make your ice cream cone, like, 2 feet tall. And get ice cream all over your fingers, and it's very creamy and good. They have really insane flavors. Yesterday there was some like I don't even know, it was like mint lentil flavor. It was really awkward. I didn't like that one. But they have lots, like blueberry, and sometimes they have miso flavor, which I don't like either. But my favorite is the chocolate. I like to get chocolate swirled with vanilla. I'm a very ordinary person, but man, it's so good.
When it came time for me to pick up a cafeteria tray and load up my own plate, I became paralyzed with anxiety. The options were overwhelming. I tried to select flavors that might meld together on my plate, but before I knew it, I had pasta with braised lamb, next to a slice of pizza with blue cheese and figs, a side of roasted squash, some mixed greens, and a slab of Humboldt Fog goat cheese on my plate. My host encouraged me to try a cucumber soda, and so I did as she said. I hadn't been at Google 3 hours, and I was pretty sure I'd begun my Google 15. As for the food, it was good. Really good. But everyone knows that food tastes that much better when it's free. For Good Food, this is Jillian Ferguson, reporting from the Google campus in Mountain View.
Stay tuned. I'll tell you what Ho Chi Minh, Malcolm X, and Parker House roles have in common. That's coming up in 30 seconds here on Good Food.
This is Jillian Ferguson, producer of Good Food. Keep up with us all week long on our blog. You'll find recipes, photos, cooking tips, and videos. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood.
Welcome back to Good Food. The Parker House role has such a particular fondness in the hearts of so many Americans. The crustless, buttery white rolls, gently folded in half, have been duplicated innumerable times in restaurants and home kitchens all across the country. Today, we thought it might be fun to get a little history lesson on the rolls, so we headed straight to the source. Dave Ritchie is the Area Director of Sales and Marketing at the Omni Parker House in downtown Boston. He joins us today. Hi, Dave.
Hi, how are you today?
Great. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
When did the Parker House open in Boston?
The Parker House goes way back. We opened in 1855 in October, and it was founded by Harvey Parker, and his vision was to build the first luxury hotel in America.
Were the dining rooms of the hotel an important part of what they were offering to the public?
Very large. I mean, when you think about back then, the hotel was the first hotel to have European plan style accommodations where you weren't told when to eat, where to eat, and what to eat. So the opulence of the dining rooms were very legendary, and you're hiring the first celebrity French chef in America.
Who was that first French chef?
Chef Cezanne from France, and he was paid $8,000 a year. And to kind of put that into perspective, the mayor across the street was only making $5,000 a year.
So where did the roll originally come from? Was it one of the cook's grandmother's recipes?
It was actually really an innovation through the years. The bakeries at the Parker House had a lot of German bakers, and a lot of other things were invented in the bakery. But I think of the most famous things would be the rolls because they're named after the hotel. But when you think about the German bakers, they were doing a lot of experimenting with different pastries and breads. And as you know, we were all used to European-style breads, and they really came up with something that was quite unique, which was basically a fluffy, white, crustless dinner roll with loads of butter in it.
Yeah, to just put it straight out there, it is the most buttery roll there is.
Yes, and it's really, today it's an iconic roll because it's really classified as America's dinner roll, so it's many people still today duplicate it.
Is there still a restaurant that serves the public at the Omni Parker?
Oh, yes, Parker's Restaurant, which Harvey Parker fired. He actually opened his restaurant before he built the hotel and then moved the restaurant into the hotel after he completed it, but it's still here today. We serve, we make the rolls fresh every day in our historic bakery, and they're hand-folded still using some of the same equipment, including the original marble table that Ho Chi Minh would have used to produce the rolls when he was an employee here in 1911.
Unbelievable. Many people may not know that about Ho Chi Minh, that he had
a period of working in a hotel kitchen.
Yes, he actually was trained professionally in Paris, France by Escoffier and got his training in Paris, then went on to London for about a year or so and then came to America and worked here at the Parker House for about a year or two.
What other famous celebrities might we have heard of who passed through those kitchens?
Well, you look at some of the other people like Emeril Lagasse. He got his start here as a young boy sous chef graduating out of culinary school and actually got his first job as a sous chef. And this is where it really launched his career. And also some other famous celebrity chefs in Boston, which is Emeril's buddies, which would be Lydia Shire and Jasper White, who are doing very well in Boston. Actually, they've opened up a couple of restaurants each, actually. So.
Now, I understand that Malcolm X worked at the hotel.
Yes, he was a busboy in our dining room in the 1950s as well.
Let's go back to the role. When were they created?
The role was perfected around in the 1876. It was right around when the German baker Bonanno, who was quite a good chef here, one of our older chefs that started out in the years here. We had some other famous Irish chefs, Doyle, who was quite famous in his day in the early 1900s. But Bonanno was really regarded as one of the big bakers because he also was found to have perfected the Boston cream pie as well, which was invented here at the Parker House.
Now, you've talked about the fold. A lot of us, when we think of a Parker House roll, we think of a slightly square or rounded roll that has many, many layers. But originally, they were folded. So describe how the fold happens.
They hand roll the bread over, and actually on the bottom, when the rolls come out of the oven, you can see where it's been folded, and it actually ends up making what we call the Parker House smile. So you can actually see the indentation of the roll where it was folded.
And before it's folded, it's dipped in melted butter?
It's in the recipe itself, in the proofing, there's butter in it, and then they're actually, before they go into the oven, they're brushed again with butter, and actually again, when they come out of the oven warm, they'll brush them one more time, and then let them sit, and then get them ready for the kitchen.
Thank you so much, Dave.
My pleasure.
Dave Ritchie is the Director of Sales and Marketing at the Omni Parker House in Boston. About 3,000 miles west of the Omni Parker lies another hotel serving up the famed crustless dinner rolls. Tim Goodell is the chef and owner of Public Kitchen and Bar at the Roosevelt Hotel in Hollywood, and I asked him to share with us his take on the Parker House roll.
These were made by my grandmother, and my grandma was a huge influence growing up in my career and my choice of what I did in life.
You cooked with her?
I did, at a very young age. I come from a family of a lot of great cooks, but my grandmother stood out head and shoulders above the rest.
And so is this recipe that you're serving at the restaurant her recipe?
It's not exactly hers, but very, very similar. A few minor adjustments that we had to make to do on a large scale.
So describe what it is about the Parker House roll that's so appealing to you.
It's very nostalgic to me. It brings back a lot of great memories growing up and having big family dinners and something that was a very reliable thing that we always would have.
And it's a yeast raised dough.
It's a straight yeast raised dough, correct. And pretty quick to make.
Is it a milk
dough?
Yeah,
there's also milk in it. The whole process is maybe a couple hours at the most from start to finish.
So is it one of those recipes where you start by melting the butter in the milk?
Yeah.
Oh, I love those.
Yeah. And we cool it down a little bit and, just bloom the yeast a bit and everything kind of goes into the bowl. Quick mix, 5 minutes in a mixer. And we let it proof, shapes rolled out, and let them rise and finish them with a little bit of cheese and salt on it and right into the oven.
Yeah, they're so delicious. The milk in the dough makes the crumb so absolutely tender. And it has those little layers in it. How do you form the rolls? I know there's different methods of forming them, the most traditional being a fold.
We just do round balls, and we put them six to a pan. We use a little cast iron skillet to do them in.
So when you get that as a diner at Public, when that little cast iron skillet comes, has it come right out of the oven? Are you individually baking those all off all throughout service?
They're individually baked off throughout service. We do a large batch at the beginning, and they're kind of reheated, but they're only an hour out of the oven typically.
Do you think putting them really close together in a pan is essential to getting the result that you like?
I do, and I like it's a little bit of an interactive thing where you get to pull them apart, the old-fashioned pull-apart type rolls.
Yeah, and then you get there's no crust on the inside.
No, on the interior side, so it's real tender underneath, and then you get a nice crust on the top part.
So there's such buttery rolls. Do you eat them with the addition of more butter?
We do. We serve them with a little bit of Vermont creamery butter that also has fleur de sel running through it, kind of adding, gilding the lily bit there.
Oh, that sounds delicious. Thank you, Tim.
You're welcome.
That was Tim Goodell. He's the chef owner at Public Kitchen and Bar in the Roosevelt Hotel. A recipe for Tim's Parker House Rolls is on the Good Food blog. Boilermakers. Most of us know what they are and have imbibed a few in our time, but they're changing, like many aspects of beer and spirits right now in America. With me this morning is Hallie Bone, one half of the Beer Chicks, who along with Christina Perozzi have a marvelous little shop at the Golden Gopher downtown called
8th Street Bottle Shop.
So let's talk about how Boilermakers have evolved. Maybe describe first, what is a Boilermaker?
Well, Boilermaker, as my grandfather used to drink, was a shot and a beer. And traditionally, you know, it was more like an after work, a way to calm down real quickly. And, you know, like with many things, it kind of ended up being more about quantity than quality. So, you know, it was more a cheap shot and a cheap beer, throw it back, relax.
And often the term Boilermaker came from actually taking the shot of whiskey and putting the entire glass, dropping it
right
into the beer.
Right. The more daring Boilermakers actually
right.
just drop it in there, which, you know, if you went to college, you may be familiar with that.
Yeah. And they foam up like crazy and
right.
you quaff it back really right. fast.
Yeah. Speed is important in that.
But now there's a type where it's not so much about speed and it's more about combining really interesting flavors.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like with everything and cocktails, we can see how the old school cocktails are coming back, where it's more about, you know, using different brown liquors and really using fresh, you know, citrus and getting back to those great ingredients. So, you know, we have been hanging out with the guys at Seven Grand, and they're known for the whiskey and the bourbon and cocktails. And so, you know, we ended up kind of talking whiskey, and we would tell them about craft beers and, you know, open a few bottles, drink a few shots. And out of that came this idea for a craft Boilermaker.
So let's start with a beer that is similar to the old style Boilermaker, something that is lighter in color, mm-hmm. lower in alcohol,
okay.
and is more of a quaffing kind of a beer.
So I would go to the Boilermaker that we have called the All-Time Hall of Famer, which is the Ballast Point Brewing Pale Ale. And that's going to be something that most beer drinkers would be familiar with. It's going to be light and crisp, nice dry hops, a little bit of citrus, low in alcohol. And we've paired that with the Bowmore Legend Island Single Malt Whiskey. So that's going to be a more of your traditional smoky whiskey. So here you have something where the beer is just going to kind of cut through the whiskey. It's going to have a little bit of citrus cleaning quality, but it's not going to get in the way of that nice smoky Isla whiskey.
Now, for some people who are Scotch heads, this mm-hmm. is just must be heresy.
Yeah, wrong.
Yeah, big time
just wrong. Well, you know, there's a place for everything, and certainly if it's a whiskey that you think should stand on its own, you know, we agree with that. You know, it's not for maybe your most prized Scotch, but you know, there is something to be said for tasting these two things together, because when you taste them together, they become something better. They combine to create new flavors, and that's what we were looking for.
So let's go up to the next step.
So another one that's really accessible for people would be, we call it the Greenhorn. So maybe for people who are not used to having Boilermakers or a little afraid of it, we have the Bushmills Black Bush Irish Whiskey with the Unibrew Ephemere Belgian-style wit beer. So Ephemere is brewed with apples and coriander. So it has this really light, crisp apple flavor without being at all sweet. And then you're pairing it with the Black Bush Irish Whiskey. So together it creates this really interesting, like, salted caramel and crisp apple flavor, almost like caramelized apples.
Really? That sounds really great. I'd like to try that one.
Yeah.
Okay, so now let's move maybe where the colors are like brown and brown.
Yes. Okay, so a good one for that is actually we do one with bourbon. This we call the Wee Heavy Buffalo. So this is the Buffalo Trace Bourbon, which a lot of people are familiar with, and the Ale Smith Wee Heavy Scotch Ale. So the Wee Heavy Scotch Ale is going to be a bigger, real malty beer, kind of heavy, dark fruit flavors to it. And when you combine that with the bourbon, it gives you kind of that rack house flavor with a little honey, black fig, and chocolate. So
Ooh, together,
it's a really rich but very parallel pairing. So together, it feels like they were really meant to be. Like, this is a great marriage.
So is there a level of super complexity, a Boilermaker, like for the rocket scientist in all of us?
The Boilermaker that we think is the most complex, the most refined, sort of higher end, we call the Little Tokyo. And this is the Suntory Yamazaki 12-year Japanese single malt with the Kyuchi Brewery's Hitachi no Nest White Ale.
Oh, that is such a great beer. Like,
yeah.
Drinking roasted pears.
It is amazing. It's probably my favorite white ale. It's one that people are familiar with. It has the beautiful, cute little owl on the bottle. And it, like you said, it has a lot of pear, a little cream soda to it. And we've paired this with a really complex single malt Japanese whiskey.
Thank you so much, Hallie. What fun.
Yes, thank you so much.
That was Hallie Bone along with Christina Perozzi. They are the Beer Chicks. They have a great little shop called 8th Street Bottle Shop that's at the bottom of the Golden Gopher. And we've been talking about really interesting Boilermaker pairings, a shot and a beer. If you missed any part of today's show, just download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also find Good Food on Demand on KCRW's apps for the iPod, Android, and BlackBerry. Good Food's produced by Jillian Ferguson. Laro Garcia and Candace Moyer are our segment producers. The executive producer is Harriet Ells. Thanks to Ronnie Mickelson and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll see you back here next week for another edition of Good Food.